Welcome back, everyone, to the Authentic as Fuck podcast. My name is San. I'm a storyteller and marketer. And in this podcast, we invite entrepreneurs and creators to share their story. Today, we have Brock Johnson. Brock Johnson is an Instagram coach. He's the Instagram coach. He has coached thousands of entrepreneurs, creators on how to grow Instagram since launching his coaching business in 2018. In 2021, his personal following blew up thanks to his reel strategy, and he's grown at a rate of approximately 1,000 followers a day since then. He has now over 700,000 followers, personally consults with Meta and Instagram staff, and is an international keynote speaker as well. Welcome, Brock.
Thank you so much. The classic, here's all the cool things intro. I appreciate that. And I appreciate you for having me on the show today. I'm excited to dive into some of these really important topics.
Awesome. Thank you for, I know you're a busy man. Thank you for being here. I'm a huge fan. I think I, you know, follow a lot of Instagram kind of coach accounts, and like yours by far is obviously, you're killing it. So congratulations on that.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you.
So yeah, like I said, this podcast is primarily about storytelling. So I want to go into kind of hearing your story. Mm-hmm. I believe, or our community believes that, you know, what you do for work, how you do it, because you do it probably different than other Instagram coaches. Mm-hmm. And, you know, why you do it. All of these things are tied to kind of your story. Like what happened throughout your life that made you the person you are today, right? So yeah. I want to, like, if you can just kind of think of few key moments you can remember throughout your life where it kind of opened your eyes. You're like, oh, I thought the world was this way, but actually it's more like this, right? And those are like the life lessons that you learn, which made you who you are. So if you can kind of like, you know, maybe start wherever you want to start and then share some of those moments where you learn some lessons. Yeah,
totally. So I think going back, telling any story about my life, but more specifically telling any story about my journey into entrepreneurship and becoming the social media marketer that I am today, it would not be complete if I didn't include how I was raised. I was raised in a very entrepreneurial family, and I was very lucky to be so. I wasn't raised by parents who told me that I had to go to college, or I had to become a doctor or a lawyer, or even that I had to get good grades. I was raised instead by parents who preached things about entrepreneurship, who were big fans of working for yourself, who very much led by example, owning their own businesses and growing and selling and buying businesses my entire life. So monkey see, monkey do is what I like to usually say to simplify it. But it wasn't like we were sitting around the kitchen table every night, you know, talking about business lessons and here's how you improve the ROAS on your business. Instead, I just, myself and my sister, got to watch our parents live by example. We got to see the really cool things about entrepreneurship, like that our parents could drive us to school and pick us up every day, and that our parents could go to every practice and every game, and they didn't have to miss important events because of work. But we also got to see, you know, the negative side of entrepreneurship, which is that when you aren't working as an entrepreneur, in many cases, you're making less money because of it. Or there's always an opportunity, you know, to open up the laptop and create a little bit more content, or to do a little bit of extra work, or to stay up late after the kids go to bed and grind just a little bit harder. And so we got to see that as well, and kind of the full scope of what it means to be an entrepreneur growing up. And so because of that, ever since I was a small child, I was starting my own air quotes businesses. And there's like a half dozen or so that I could name. One, I think the very first one that was like an actual semblance of a business besides just a lemonade stand, was called Lace My Kicks. And it was called Lace My Kicks because I had a website that was lacemykicks.com. I don't think it's available anymore. But for Christmas, I got this book that showed you like different ways that you could tie people's shoes and lace up people's shoes with like different patterns and weaving and colors. And I thought it was the coolest thing. So I started doing my own shoelaces like that. And then my classmates were like, how'd you get that? How did you do that? And so I started charging them. So without telling my parents, I think it was like 10 bucks or something. And I told people if they gave me 10 bucks, they could bring me a pair of shoes, their shoes to school. I would take it home, lace it up, and bring it back for them the next day. And so my mom tells the story of one day she comes to pick me up from elementary school and I have like a bag full of smelly shoes from all of my classmates that I was bringing home to lace up for them. So that was like really the beginning of my entrepreneurial spirit and wanting to make money and hustle and do these little things. That's your lemonade stand. Yeah, there was a bunch of other little businesses after that. But then when I went off to college is where I really started to take this whole entrepreneurship thing more seriously. And that's really my freshman year of college is the genesis of how I got to where I am today.
Got it. So let's get a little bit into that. But before we do, quickly, so when you were growing up, did you know that your kind of, you know, your parents, what they do for work and that lifestyle is not the norm, so to speak?
I was aware of that because a lot of my friends weren't in the same category as me. My friends' parents work normal jobs. One of my best friend's dads was a police officer. Another good friend's dad was a salesman. And so I was aware that what my parents were able to provide and what they were able to do, the life they were able to live, it was unique. I was aware of that early on.
Got it. Awesome. And like you said before, you saw the pros and cons.
Yeah.
Because you're able to compare it with other people.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. So you kind of, I guess, you were kind of born in that entrepreneur, I guess, family. And it was kind of like, you know, us as Asians were like doctor, lawyer, engineer.
Yeah. Yeah.
You were like, you know, created to be an entrepreneur. So
basically,
were there during that time, all up until college year, was there anything that you, significant life lesson you learned during that time that made you go like, oh, the world is, I thought the world was this way, but actually it's like this, you know, something like that?
Yeah, I think probably the biggest thing that I learned early on was just the importance of action and being able to take action and pursue the things that you had ideas for or had dreams for. My parents were very, very encouraging of any oddball ideas or any sports or anything that my sister and I wanted to try. And so they really instilled in us from that early age that if you want to do something, go after it. They were realistic about whether or not things were possible, but you can be, I think, realistic about whether or not something is possible and still have that belief in yourself that you can do it or that you can persevere or you can start that business. They taught us that really, really early on. And that stuck with me. I mean, to this day, if I have a random idea, I might not always follow it now. But I definitely have a belief that, yeah, if I work at that and I take action, I can make it successful, or I can achieve that dream or that goal or whatever it may be.
Yeah. That kind of positive, like that it is possible.
Yeah.
But, so also, is that something that you knew back then, or is that something like later in life you realized, oh, that's something special? Most people actually don't just believe in themselves, or most people don't take the risk or don't just take action.
Yeah, I think that was something that I probably learned retrospectively looking back at my childhood. I think I was, you know, my family, especially like my dad's side of the family, comes from a very athletic background. And honestly, like a pretty cocky background where they're like, yeah, I'm the best. I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to be the best at whatever I do. We're the best. And so there's like, I fully recognize the double-edged sword that can be, and the problems and the egotism that can create. But I also recognize that for a child growing up, especially one who wants to be an entrepreneur or wants to have these big, crazy dreams, that can be very helpful. That like self-confidence can be a real booster.
Yeah. I actually see huge similarity between sports and entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. Also like between video game and entrepreneurship, or like poker and like, and yeah, a lot of what you say is that taking that risk is, it's so like, maybe it's ego, but I feel like in sports, you kind of need that, right? You need a little bit of delusional confidence.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Then, I agree. Yeah, 1,000%. And I think like, if you think of any of the best athletes ever, and the best of the best, they're all nuts. Like Kobe, LeBron, Michael Jordan, they're all nuts. Peyton Manning, Tom Brady, Tiger Woods, crazy. You name the best of the best at any sport. Caitlin Clark, you know, all over the news right now. She is crazy. They're all definitely crazy obsessed. They have a crazy self-belief in order to make these things possible. But even on a smaller scale, athletes in general, high performers, people who are good at their sports or are good at video games or are good at high risk things like poker, they have that self-belief. It's necessary to have kind of an unrealistic self-belief in order to be good at those things.
Yeah. And I think because I think what makes them special than other people who are just delusional is that those people have that self-belief, but they also have somewhat of a humility to know when they did something wrong to work on it and improve and things like that. Yeah. So it's like a fine balance between that humility and
1,000%, 1,000%. Cause there's also plenty of athletes who have unfounded self-belief and won't work on anything. And that's the downfall of many athletes. Right.
Yeah.
So like, you know, the greats in any sport or any field definitely walk that fine line between thinking I am the best, but also recognizing here are my shortcomings that I can improve on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm really glad that you shared this part of the story because I always tell people that, like, actually, you know, huge part of your story, huge part of who you are actually comes from your childhood, how you were raised. And, you know, because like you said, just through osmosis, we watch how our parents act and we're like, oh, that's how it's supposed to act. And, you know, that's how we live life. And I think it's an important part. And even if it's like you, I think, grew up in an ideal situation for an entrepreneur. But even if you didn't, I think there are people who can understand, okay, I didn't grow up in this environment, but in the environment that I grew up, what can I get out of it that's a positive?
Mm-hmm.
And then throw away that's a negative. And then like something like that, right? But I think this is a good example of how like your upbringing has... You know, and, you know, your mother is all, because I started following your mom first, Charlene, and she's also she used to do Instagram coaching as well, right? Or entrepreneurship coaching.
To some degree. She's always been very good since she was in high school, even very good at marketing. And so she's never done like one-on-one Instagram coaching, but she's always understood Instagram from a marketing perspective. Even when Instagram launched in 2012, I remember she had hundreds of thousands of followers and was, you know, using it for marketing. And so because of her background using Instagram for marketing for her businesses, she also just understands how to teach other people to use Instagram to market for their businesses. So she is a hardcore ADHD entrepreneur. So she's had a million different niches and a lot of people know her for different things. A lot of people know her for fitness. A lot of people know her as, you know, a business coach, marketing coach, Instagram coach. And now there's, you know, a million different niches. She likes to joke with me sometimes like, hey, I just unlocked a new niche today. I have a new passion that I'm going to be obsessing about for the next few months. That's very much how she is. And, you know, a lot of people have found me through her.
That's awesome. I think because not every ADHD entrepreneur succeeds, right? Because they can't focus on one thing, but then like, if you can figure out how to make it work, I mean, that's amazing, you know, like.
Yeah. She's definitely found a way to turn ADHD into her superpower as her son, but also as someone who works with her. We're business partners in a couple different ventures. I can see both sides of her ADHD and I can see how sometimes it is such a blessing for her and she's able to hyper-focus on things that other people would not care about. And she's able to deep dive into topics and become an expert in a matter of months when it might take someone else years. But then also a few months later, she might be completely over that thing and not interested in it anymore and pursuing a new venture. But she's definitely one of the lucky ones or the ones who can, you know, have success despite their shiny object syndrome.
Do you think it's just having the right people around? Like, you know,
I think she's
managed to create a system like
that? I think that's part of it. I think she definitely has systems in place to help herself. I think that especially the people who have been on her team/our team for years, are key. Like my dad is absolutely one of them. He is their CFO. He is very type A. He will support her and make, you know, all of her dreams that she wants possible and tell her how to make them possible, while also being realistic about like the budget and the monetary side. How much can we spend? How much time can we devote to this? So that's really key. Yeah, her assistant has been with us for 20 years now, and it feels so silly to call her my mom's assistant, because at this point she's really my mom's life manager. She like makes sure that everything that my mom's brain needs at different times is checked off, and that's really key. And so the fact that my mom found her when she did was such a godsend, and she's honestly more like a family member at this point than an assistant or, you know, just another person on the team.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, it sounds like she's created like a good environment around her so that she can, you know, get the most out of her ADHD.
Yeah, totally. Awesome. Yeah.
So yeah, let's move on to the next part of your story. So maybe you'll talk a little bit more about how you got into Instagram, your freshman year.
Yeah. So like I said, my freshman year of college when I was 18 or 19 was really the genesis of how we got to where we are today. And it was at that time I was going to school on the opposite side of the country from my family. So born and raised in California, but I was going to school in Washington, D.C. at Georgetown. I'd played football my whole life. So I was out there playing football, and I was there for the summer, because when you're a student athlete, very often you enroll the summer before the actual next school year starts. So I'm there in the summer, and there's not much to do besides go to your 6 a.m. workout, go to your one summer class at like 10 a.m., and then you're done for the rest of the day. And I was feeling guilty with all this alone time and having my parents at that point still pay for everything. I was a freshman, and because I, you know, had this full schedule, I couldn't necessarily work a traditional job. And also it was always a goal for myself to never have a boss. That was a goal I set very young, was to never have someone besides a coach tell me what to do. And so I came to this point where it was kind of a no-brainer. There weren't any other options. If I wanted to provide for myself, detach that financial umbilical cord from my parents so that I could financially provide for myself, and do so that in a way that still fit into my goals and my time. So I launched a business at that time, which was, again, very similar to the Lace My Kicks thing. It was a business that wasn't something that I necessarily wanted to do for the rest of my life. It wasn't something that I was necessarily ultra passionate about. It was something where I had developed a unique skill. I saw the need for said skill, and I launched the business. So in Lace My Kicks, I had developed the skill of lacing up shoes in a cool way. I saw the need because my classmates thought it was cool and they wanted it for themselves, started the business. In college, my freshman year, it was Snapchat. At that time, it was 2016, and there was two hot things in the summer of 2016. It was Pokemon Go and Snapchat. And Snapchat was the scary one because it was like, what's going on this app? Like, there's disappearing photos. And you have to remember contextually, this was before the days of Instagram stories. This was before the days of Reels. This was before TikTok even existed. So Snapchat was like a big player in the game. And a lot of parents were really scared, but I had developed this skill of teaching people above the age of 40, how to use Snapchat, because of the position I was in. I didn't want to text my parents all day. And I was living across the country from them. I didn't want to like call them and FaceTime them and debrief. I would rather just Snapchat them, right? I'm walking around this cool campus. I'm walking down by the White House, and I want to just send my parents little snaps. So I taught them how to use Snapchat. I developed that skill of being able to teach people in their 40s how to use Snapchat. And thus my very first real business, which was called Unwrap Snap, began. And that's exactly what it was. It was teaching primarily moms how to keep their kids safe on Snapchat, teaching them how to use the app, what was really going on, how to look for things and just keep tabs on their kids so that they could.
And it was online, safer. Like an online course.
Yeah, it was an online course. It was an e-course. After having the idea for the business, I rented out a room in the Georgetown library, and I sat in there for 7 hours a day for a week and a half straight, filmed every single lesson, every content. I actually still have the microphone. I still use the microphone that I used back then. It was like a $10 mic off Amazon. I didn't even have a tripod and I didn't have a camera. So every lesson was filmed on my phone, and my phone was propped up on some books from the library. And that was my initial course. I think I sold it for like $19.99, you know, $20. Mm-hmm. And that business was launched in November of that year.
Got it. And how did that go?
It went well. It by no means was something that was going to change my life. But I think I had maybe 1,000 or 2,000 total people purchase the course in the
At
year.
At this point,
so
did you already have an audience, or you
had a started? I had a decent audience. It was nowhere near where it was today. I would say maybe 20 to 30,000 followers on Instagram, probably maybe even less than that back then, like maybe 20,000 followers, not a massive audience. I very much relied on word of mouth at that point, having moms tell other moms, having customers tell other customers like, hey, check this out. You know, it's $20. You'll learn what you need to know to keep your kids safe.
Yeah. It sounds like there's a pattern here. Like, it sounds like all the business that you go into, maybe even if you like, you don't hit a home run, they're not, it's risk adverse because you've already kind of tested the market, right?
Like, in a way. Yeah, definitely.
Like, you're only doing the things that you know you've already done and you tried and you know it works, you know, there's a demand for it. And then you're kind of,
Yeah. I think that's kind of just how I think about business in general. That's how I view entrepreneurship. I view entrepreneurs as paid problem solvers. And so the way I look at it is, once I've solved a problem for myself, I could teach other people how to solve that problem for themselves, and because that problem is a real nuisance, you know, that me teaching them how to do it has monetary value, and that's what I'm selling.
You hit a point. So what you're doing is, as an entrepreneur, you're solving problems, which is, I think everybody understands that. I think the part that most people don't understand is most people I see have a solution without a problem.
Yeah.
And they're trying to sell the solution, right? What you did was, you didn't invent the problem solution without the problem. These were problems that you're already facing in life. So you already knew kind of it's in demand because you're facing it, obviously.
Yeah. I think when you go about inventing problems, it becomes a lot harder to sell and market your thing, because you don't just have to do the job of convincing the person to buy. You first have to convince them that this problem that they don't even know that they have, or that they might not even have, and now they suddenly have to have this problem, and then they have to buy your thing to solve their problem that they didn't know they had 5 minutes ago. It makes it a lot tougher.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So what happened after this business? Well,
yeah. So this business evolved into basically what I do today, which is helping people grow their brand or business on social media. The way in which that happened was, again, figuring out the solution to a problem, and then marketing said solution. So very soon after I had taught 1,000 or 2,000 people, moms primarily, how to keep their kids safe on Snapchat, I now had 1,000 to 2,000 people who I had developed trust and a relationship with, who now had access to this new social media platform. And a lot of them had their own Snapchat accounts now. And a lot of them, because they were moms, because they were people who were like stay-at-home parents, they wanted to work from home. They wanted to, maybe they were in network marketing, or they wanted to create a side hustle or sell stuff from their home without getting a traditional 9-to-5 job. And so I was essentially like, hey, I figured out how to market on Snapchat. I used Snapchat to market the course. So let me teach everyone else how to market on Snapchat. Mm-hmm. And thus, Unwrap Snap, which originally was for parents, transformed into Unwrap Snap for business. And it evolved into a way not just to teach people how to use Snapchat to keep their kids safe, but how to use Snapchat as a marketing tool, how to use Snapchat to reach your audience and build trust, and Snapchat stories and all of those things. And so that evolved into a much more robust course with more information and had a lot of marketing principles in it. And then a few months after that launched, it kind of was kind of lucked out on this thing. I was, again, a college football player, and the NCAA at that time was super strict. Nowadays, there's the NIL thing, name, image, likeness, where student athletes can make all the money they want doing whatever they want. Like, they can promote the local burger shop and get free burgers. Like, they can do whatever they want. But when I was in college, it was the opposite. It was, if you want to make money, you need to get the stamp of approval by the NCAA. And because I was marketing this myself, I had my face on it everywhere in it. I was the one doing the marketing. The NCAA is like, whoa, whoa, whoa. We need to do a full investigation. You have to shut down all business operations, no new customers, no new sales, nothing. You have to press halt, or else we might make you refund all your customers or donate all your profits or something like that. So for 6 months, I couldn't do anything business related. Fortunately, I was still a full-time student athlete. So like I had enough stuff to do. I wasn't bored. But for those 6 months, I couldn't do anything business related. And the reason I say that this was actually very lucky and I was very fortunate that this happened, it was a blessing in disguise, was because during those 6 months, Instagram launched Instagram stories. And with the launch of Instagram stories, there was a mass exodus from Snapchat. I think it was led by Kylie Jenner. She made like the first announcement of, I'm leaving Snap. I'm going to Instagram only. I'm just going to use Instagram stories. Goodbye, Snapchat. And with her went tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, probably even millions of people. And so it just kind of worked out well that once the NCAA was like, okay, you're good to go. You can run your business. Yeah. You're not doing anything illegal. It was a perfect time for me to rebrand and relaunch with the focus on Instagram rather than focusing on Snapchat.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I definitely think there are some luck involved in entrepreneurship. And there's multiple, right? But then I also feel like there we also get bad lucks. Sometimes so like if you actually add up all the bad lucks and good lucks, they probably even out, right? But I think probably, we don't realize how much we depend on those type of luck. I wanted to quickly ask you. Oh, go ahead.
Oh no, I was just going to agree that absolutely, luck absolutely has a role to play.
Okay, yeah, okay. So before you use the word guilt, because this caught my attention when you said when you were in college and in the summer you had all this free time and you felt guilty. Mm-hmm. And like, it's hard for me to imagine like a 19-year-old freshman in college feeling guilty for wasting time or something. Like, is that so where do you think that came from? Because like, that's definitely not, I don't think, the norm. Is that kind of ingrained in you?
Yeah, I would agree. I definitely don't think that's the norm. I think first and foremost, my parents did a really good job of making sure that when my sister and I were being raised, we didn't feel bad or guilty of the things that we were fortunate enough to have, but we were able to recognize the blessings that were in our life. And we were raised in a very comfortable lifestyle where my parents had multiple successful businesses. And so we had the cool house, we had the fancy vacations. And it was something that, again, it just growing up, it was like you're aware that these things are not normal and that these things are blessings and that these things are the result of hard work and having good luck and et cetera, et cetera. And so when I got to my freshman year of college, I looked around and Georgetown was a especially unique experience as a college football player because half of the team was kids who grew up in the Northeast and their dad also went to Georgetown and their grandpa also went to Georgetown and they were very wealthy and affluent. And they got into the school, you know, I'm sure on their own merits, but probably also a little bit because their dad and their grandpa also were big donors. And that was half the team. And the other half the team was kids from very challenged backgrounds, very impoverished areas, kids who really struggled and had to work their ass off to get the best possible grades and be the best possible athlete just to barely afford to get the scholarship to go to Georgetown. But then when they're on scholarship, it's not like they're getting cash the way like a lot of athletes are today. They're not just getting paid. Back at that time, if you were on scholarship, you know, you were getting your housing paid for, you were getting your tuition paid for. but you were still on your own for like paying for your groceries. So I got to see what that looked like. And I was the only kid on the team who was from west of the Mississippi. So I was kind of like, I don't really fit in with either group. I don't come from like old money and I've been, you know, generations going to the school, but I also don't come from an impoverished background. And so being able to see that right in front of me in such black and white, but also being like, I have this credit card that my parents pay for that they said I can use for groceries or whatever I want. It just didn't feel right. It didn't feel right coming home to, my six other roommates who were all hungry. And I was just like, oh, mommy and daddy bought my lunch. So I wanted to be able to provide those things for myself and for my friends. I wanted to be able to take my friends out to lunch and pay for the meal and not be like, it's on mommy and daddy, but no, it's on me because I worked for this. So I definitely recognize that that's not
normal. Yeah, I guess those are just values that are instilled in us from a very, because like I feel like that too, but I do meet people who don't feel that way at all.
Also, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's a show on Netflix called it's called The Trust, and it's a show where they're basically like trying to figure out who is getting what percentage of this trust, and it's kind of like Survivor. Like Squid Game.
Yeah, I know which one.
They're voting people off. But it's interesting that show to see how people view money and how people view earning money or deserving money. And it's an interesting, you know, kind of reality TV light watch. But it's to your point, just different people have different values.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like, just from this quick story I hear, it sounds like, most people grew up in an environment where they're worried about money. When I talk to people and they say, oh, they want to make money or they want to start a business, most of them are not coming to me going like, I want to be a billionaire. They're like, I just want to have enough safety, securities. If I want to be financially secure so I don't have to worry about money when I go vacations. Blah, blah, blah. Like they, nobody wants, like most of them don't want to be billionaires, right? Mm-hmm. And I think what happens is, I think most people look at money as just something they need to survive, right? And when you look at money that way, I think they fear money. And there's like an emotions, a lot of emotions attached to it. And you don't just look at it as numbers. Whereas it sounds like for you, you never grew up with that scarcity mindset. You saw it, but you also understood the value of like, this is not free. This comes with responsibility. Like you saw all of that. So maybe that value was still instilled in you, like knowing that I should feel guilty about wasting my time right now.
I think that's very perceptive of you to notice that. I think that's absolutely true. My parents were very intentional when I was growing up about instilling a growth mindset or an abundance mindset in my sister and I. That was something that was explicitly talked about in our family growing up. So we did not have a scarcity mindset. And to your point, we viewed money as a tool that could be used in the same way that time can be used. And money is a tool that can buy you more time rather than spending your time to make money. So we were learning from a very early age about outsourcing and delegating and hiring a team and the way you could invest to use your money to make more money. And so that was definitely a byproduct of the way I was raised.
Is there something during those college years when you saw those kind of two half of the football team and just in general during your college year, was there any kind of big lesson that you took away? Like, I used to believe the world was like this. Like, I would imagine if I was in that situation, I saw that happening in the locker room or whatever, like that would be a huge culture shock for me. And I wouldn't know how to behave, like, because I'm sure there's like, you know what I mean? Because like they're, at the end of the day, they're teammates, they're friends and they're bros.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But they're worlds apart too at the same time. Right. Like,
yeah. Yeah. It was definitely an interesting time and a lot to learn. I think my biggest life lessons that I've learned in life in general happened from being a college football player. I don't know if it was necessarily all what I had just described in kind of that dichotomy in the locker room. It was a lot of lessons that were taught to me by my coaches and stuff like that. But during that time, it was definitely a unique challenge that I recognized being, like I said, the only person from the other side of the Mississippi. So I very much had to pick, like, who do I want to hang out with? And there was a clear division in the locker room. One group hangs out with one group, one group hangs out with the other group. And even though I might have looked more like the kids from the Northeast whose five generations of dads and grandpas all went to Georgetown, I felt like I fit in more and I resonated more and I connected more with the kids who didn't have as fortunate of a background. So that might have even multiplied the feelings that I was feeling of seeing people struggle. But it was an interesting time. And I also want to say I didn't spend my whole career at Georgetown. I was actually only there for my freshman year. So then I transferred and went to school in Northern California at UC Davis. And that was a place where I had some really, really great coaches who were very different than your typical, you know, stereotypical college football coach. And a lot of my life lessons come from my time at UC Davis.
Yeah. And is that where you, because I know you also kind of became TikTok famous, right? Doing those dances.
Yeah.
in your locker rooms and stuff.
Yeah, that was during that time. That was all at UC Davis. Again, something that was very fortunate where if I was at Georgetown, I don't know if that would have happened. But that was something where when I was at Davis, one of my very best friends was very similar to me in that, in pretty much every way, but specifically in that he was not ashamed to dance and be goofy and be loud and, film himself on camera. And so when TikTok first launched at the very end of 2018, I started hearing about it, downloaded it, and then I posted my first TikTok in, I think it was January of 2019. So long before most people had heard of TikTok. And I blew up, and me and that best friend recorded a couple different videos in a few days in a row that were just dancing videos, kind of silly, goofy, posted them on TikTok. And it was like million views, 12 million views, 15 million views, video after video. And so in a matter of a couple days, I had like 300,000 followers on TikTok. And at this time it was still an app that no one had heard of. Like, I remember the first time filming a TikTok in the locker room. I got a big group of guys together and I was like, let's all do this dance. It's going to be super simple. I'll show you what to do. I'm going to film it for 10 seconds and post it on TikTok. If you were to say that in a locker room today, everyone would know what TikTok is. And the majority of the guys in the locker room would be like, hell no. Like, I ain't doing that. I ain't dancing on TikTok. But at that stage, no one knew what it was. No one had TikTok downloaded. There weren't these stereotypes around it. And so everyone's like, okay, sure, I'll do that. And that ended up being like the most viral video because there was like 20 of us in the locker room. And so again, that was something that I don't think would have happened at Georgetown, but happened at UC Davis. And big shout out to Darius, my best friend, for being someone who continually was like always down to do a dance with me. And yeah, that was a crazy
wild
ride.
So that was just for fun.
Yeah, just for fun. I wasn't, and this is kind of a regret. I wasn't thinking about it from the marketing perspective at that time. I hadn't blown up on Instagram yet, so I was still at maybe 40,000 followers on Instagram. I was an Instagram coach. That was my focus. But when TikTok launched, I didn't see the potential. I just was like, I'm going to dance. I'm going to have fun. 300,000 followers in a matter of a couple days. But the problem was all of those followers only wanted dancing. So when it came to talking about the stuff we're talking about today, entrepreneurship, social media marketing, growing on social, they didn't care. They were like, just put your shoulder pads back on and do some more twerking in the locker room. Like, we don't care for this stuff. And so that is
was that a shock for you? When you found that out?
The shock of the videos going viral or which shock?
Or like, obviously, I'm assuming that was a shock going viral.
Yes.
But when you try to actually like monetize this audience or do something with it and realize that all they want is dancing from you.
I don't know if it was a shock. I think just because, like you and I, we have this knowledge, this background, and it makes sense. And I went into it kind of expecting, hey, I know that these followers don't follow me for this topic. They don't even know that I have this expertise. Okay. So it wasn't a shock, but it was definitely a disappointment. And it was definitely a bummer. It was kind of,
it was a missed opportunity.
It wasn't a waste, but it was, it felt wasteful.
Yeah, that's true. I actually think that's kind of what happens, right? Like when I started growing Instagram in the beginning, I actually didn't care about followers. I'll spend 2 hours making a post, post it and get like one follower and I'll be ecstatic, right?
Yeah.
And then at some point, like when I started getting like 50 followers, 100 followers, like that's when I actually started fearing getting no like followers or something like that. And it's like, you know, if you had zero followers on TikTok, the fact that you didn't, you couldn't monetize that, you wouldn't care at all. But the fact that you had 300,000 followers there, it's like so close, but so far.
I know. I was like, like it's on one hand, it's a claim to fame. Like I can tell people I built a TikTok with over 300,000 followers, and that's true. But on the other hand, it's like I can't do anything with them. Like they're not very valuable followers.
Yeah. So how is that what kind of got you into switching that over to Instagram?
Yeah, no, it was, they were kind of separate, honestly. I never really intermeshed the two. I viewed them as separate. Like I would post educational tips, tutorials, trainings on Instagram. And then I would go to TikTok and I would put on my dance party hat and I would make like a little funny trend. But over time, I was just like,
personal business.
Yeah, personal and business. Yeah, but over time, I was just like, I'm not a dancer. I love dancing, but I'm not a dancer. I don't want to just make silly videos every single day. It doesn't feel like there's a real return on investment. And then my Instagram really started to take off and blow up. And this was in early 2021. So once my Instagram started to take off, then I was like, I'm just going to pour all of my energy and attention into Instagram and kind of let TikTok sizzle out.
Got it. And did you kind of figure that all out through trial and error? Did you learn from people? Like, how did you kind of learn, hone in your skills?
A lot of it was trial and error. I have been creating content for a very long time. When I was growing up, I had a YouTube channel where I did like basketball trick shots. And so that was like my first real social media where I learned about consistency and creativity and planning and scripting and editing and all of those skills. So years and years of doing that, I had, you know, I was posting on Vine very regularly when Vine was a thing. And then I do think I learned a lot about short form content creation through my days on TikTok, through my, viral videos that I was creating there. I learned a lot about those processes and the skills so that when Instagram launched Reels, I had all these tools in my toolkit already of like, how do you create a hook? How do you get someone engaged? How do you edit the video? Like those simple minor things that might have taken other people weeks or months to catch up on. Day one of Reels being a feature, I was posting them and I was ready to get going.
Oh, that's awesome. Okay, so what's the rest of the story from there to now?
From there to now is, again, transition from Snapchat to Instagram once I came back from the six month hiatus. And the first, I would say, 2 or 3 years of Instagram growth was slow. And I wouldn't even call it steady. There was, you know, a couple followers every single month. And I was, by the time...
Was this before or after Reels?
Before. So this was like from 2018. So there was no Reels. Yeah, 2018 to 2020. There wasn't this like crazy growth potential that we have now with Reels. Unless you got a million shares or, you know, got a shout out from a celebrity, it was tough to, or, you know, your hashtags were just hitting. It was tough to really have that much success, the way it is now, on Instagram. And so it was 2 years of a slow burn, but during those 2 years, I was coaching my ass off. I was, football practice for 4 hours in the morning. I'd go to class for a couple hours in the middle of the day, and then I would bike home as fast as I can. And the number of coaching calls that I had where my upper half was presentable and I was wearing like a nice t-shirt and my lower half, I still had my cleats on. Like I was still laced up from practice or whatever. I was still sweaty. Like I smelled disgusting, but I would have 3 or 4 calls that afternoon and I would do this day after day. And so I coached one-on-one well over 300 or 400 people over the course of a year or two. And I learned so much during that time, not just about how to grow on Instagram, but what I really learned was what are people actually struggling with? Like what actually are the pain points? What are they tripping over? What are they sucking at? What do they need more? When do they need like a pat on the butt and like a, hey, you got this? And when do they need that harsh love? That's what I learned during that time. And then
like how to teach people.
Yeah. How to do it virtually. And how to do it, you know, over camera. So I was having like, go ahead.
Do you think Being in a football team, kind of, did you learn any similar skills from there that transferred to 1,000%. Your foot?
Every great trait that I have as an entrepreneur or a content creator or an Instagram coach is from either something that my parents taught me as a child or probably primarily my background being a football player.
Yeah.
Everything about...
I understand the importance of leadership in a team, like in a football team, right? Like if you watch, like, I don't know if you watch Ted Lasso, but like that kind of draws like a perfect picture of like how important a leader is inside a team, right?
Yeah.
So 1,000%. I would imagine a lot of that applies off the field as well, you know?
Yeah, 1,000%. And then you add on top of that like I wasn't just in the sport or playing the sport, but I was the quarterback, which doesn't take an expert to figure out that like the quarterback is the leader. It's the person who has to be vocal. It's the person who has to be able to speak to a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds who are challenged by a lot of different things. You know, you might have one guy on your team who's from Michigan, another guy from Florida, another guy from California, and they all have these different backgrounds. So being able rally them together and teach them and bring them all together for the same mission was something that I was watching and learning and practicing my whole life long before I got into Instagram coaching.
Oh, that's amazing, man. Like it sounds like, cause like, I feel like one of the hardest things to do in that kind of situation is to kind of like controlling your ego. Right.
Yeah.
And a lot of us, we have a hard time doing that, but it almost sounds like kind of you were trained for this like role, like you were trained for the role where you cause like even working with different types of people, you got to kind of drop your ego a little bit.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's some technical skills, like for example, because like as a quarterback, you have to like make quick decisions. I'm sure those kind of skills also come into play as well in business.
Yeah. 1,000%. There's like so many parallels between not just football and being a content creator or business owner, but like being a quarterback and being an entrepreneur, being a business owner. It's scary sometimes when I start to like think about the list in my brain of how many connections there are.
Yeah. And another question I had was, so when you said you were coaching, like you were going crazy coaching.
Yeah.
What was your motivation? Cause like when I look at coaches who work hard, like they have different, like one of them is like, they just care about money. Right. So they're just like, boom, 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 boom. Like one of them is like genuinely love talking to people. Some of them are like actually trying to build up their brand. Like they have different, like what kept you going?
That's a great question. I think I do love talking to people. I am an extrovert, but I don't love one-on-one coaching. It's why I don't do it anymore. I did it over all those years and I did enjoy it at the time, but I also recognized that it was draining. I didn't necessarily do it to build a brand. I wasn't that forward thinking that, hey, I'm going to establish this like presence for myself. It was really just, I have this skill. I want to teach other people how to have success with this same skill. So a big part of it is helping others. That's something that's always been very important to me. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Enneagram, but I'm a 2-wing 1, which is the 2 is the helper and the 1 is the perfectionist. So I'm like a helper who has like a little seasoning of perfectionism sprinkled on top. So like helping others and coaching people has always been in my DNA. It's always been who I am. And I think the reason I was able to just keep doing it was I was having success. I think that's important. I think when people have success early on, it's such a motivating factor to keep doing it, keep on keeping on. And then also just because of my background in sports, it had been ingrained in me that you work hard, you show up. You don't necessarily, you know, like hustle culture or whatever, but you're disciplined, like you said, enough to just keep showing up, keep putting in the work, keep putting in the effort, and you will see results.
Yeah. Was it like when you were doing all those coaching, was it like kind of a, like this where it was fun, but then was there a curve where it started not becoming fun?
Like, yeah, that was, that was April, May, June of 2020. So I had been, you know, fun, coaching. literally. And it was in large part because of COVID. So I was like coaching 2, maybe 3 calls max a day, doing a lot of group calls in 2018 to 2020. And then March of 2020 hits and suddenly everyone wants to grow on social media and everyone wants to build a business online. And I am suddenly having more success. So now I have 50 or 60,000 followers and I hadn't raised my prices yet. And so there was a 2 or 3 month period where I was working a 9 to 5 for myself. And it was more like a 7 to 6, like from 7 a.m. till 6 at night, back to back to back to back to back calls. Literally, it got to the point where I had to tell my now wife, at the time girlfriend, hey, I'm not going to be able to leave this room for the next 11 hours. So at some point, can you just like slide food under the door? And this is like literally, she would like throw protein bars under the door and I would like be on my call, like snacking on them while the person's talking. I'd be like, sorry, my video is not working. In reality, I'm eating a Clif bar. And it got to the point where I was like, I can't do this anymore. I am drained. I am burnt out. Like I just cannot physically sit on another Zoom call for 11 hours a day. And so that's when I transitioned and I stopped doing so much one-on-one coaching.
So, I mean, I'm surprised that you stuck it out that long, because like most people probably wouldn't even do, but I get like you said, kind of the discipline thing.
Yeah.
But I also think, let me know if this feels true. Like for me, when I start doing something new, it's more fun because there's challenge. I'm learning new stuff every time. It's challenging, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But then there comes like a learning curve comes to an end where, okay, now I'm not learning as much. Like I have to do 10 coaching calls before I learn one new thing or something like that. It's just not worth it anymore.
Yes. Yeah. No, you hit the nail on the head. It's scary. It's like you were in the room with me in so many of these questions you're asking. Yeah. It got to the point where it was like, I'm having the same conversation over and over and I'm not learning new things myself. I'm just kind of babysitting.
Yeah. And I think that just goes to show you how much, like, I actually think that if everyone just focuses on, if you want to grow Instagram, instead of focusing on growth, focusing on learning, because the learning part is fun, you'll actually last longer, kind of like you did.
Yeah, 1,000%. And to that point, to this day, that's still why I like love Instagram. And I am so excited. I'm still to this day excited every day to get to do what I do, because I view it as learning. Every day I'm like learning a new thing about Instagram. I'm trying out a new strategy and trying to figure out what's working right now. And so that's what keeps me going.
Yeah. And I can totally see that, like from your membership, like how, like, I think it's brilliant what you guys did, because Instagram is always changing and you guys have the data, right? Because you guys are like pretty much the biggest Instagram growth platform. So like, you know what works and you know what doesn't work because you have the numbers, and it's just so, it really is a club.
Well, yeah, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, and this fits perfectly into the story, because that's where the club came from. Was I was doing so many hours a day of coaching, and I was also at this time, again, like, it's crazy how these things work out in this way. Because of COVID, I was living at home. I was a college student, but now I couldn't go to class and I, you know, school was shut down. So I was living at home with my mom. And I was like, I came to her one night and I was like, we need to create something where people can learn about Instagram, but it's not a course. Because at that point I had like 3 or 4 courses, and I was like, if I just keep making courses, I'm going to constantly be in this kind of cycle of like, okay, I'm going to make this new course, I'm going to market it for a few months, and now it's outdated. And so now what? Do I like update it, but those people don't buy it again? Do I make a new course and now I'm like selling to the same people who I just sold this course to? So I was like, let's make a membership so that people can subscribe to this club and they can get all the access when it happens. And it's just evergreen. It's living, it's alive, it's ever changing. And so that's where the Insta Club Hub came from. We launched it in, I believe, October of 2020. So a few months later. And now we've had over 40,000 members. And so to your point, we have the volume where we have a lot of data. We have a lot of numbers. We have a lot of people who can give us feedback and a lot of learning. And now we even literally have a full-time staff member who has her PhD in Instagram. She did her dissertation on a qualitative analysis of Instagram. She teaches communication at a university, and her job for us is to comb through the data and do studies and collect numbers and figure out like not what do we think is working? But like, based off the numbers, what is actually working?
Yeah.
And so
I feel like that data really alone.
Fun. Yeah.
Is so valuable. It's way more valuable than the price of the membership because like, let me tell you a story. Like I had a client who like a long time ago came to us and we built a couple membership portals for our custom membership portals, our agency, for clients. And they wanted us to, they wanted to invest like $150,000 to build a custom portal. And I actually told them, it's like, you know, like we actually did it with these influencers and all of them within a year ended up going back to Facebook group or Slack because none of the members like wanted to log into the new portal. And that's something that we learned through experience, right? So I would actually say save your $150,000 and just use Facebook group or use Slack or use an existing platform, right? And that pretty much that one thing, one information saved her 6 months of time and $150,000. And that's pretty much what you're doing, right? When you're say, okay, as a fitness coach, your engagement rate should be about here. But the fact that you're here, you're actually doing better than average. Like most people wouldn't know that, right? Or if you're doing worse, you're like getting no engagement. Like they don't even know that. They're like, oh, I guess I'm doing fine.
Exactly. Exactly. The not knowing is so huge. And so just being able to look at the actual numbers is so valuable. And it's also fun. It's fun to be able to do some research and figure out these insights and these stats.
Yeah. I love it. I love the content that you put out. Like you always like, seems like you always tinker with stuff and you see what's working, what's not working and you share it. And I guess kind of one last question I have for you is, and maybe we can kind of try to tie a bow around it. what, from your audience and your members and your customers, what is the one thing you wish you can like, show, like what is like the one myth that they believe in, right? The one false belief that they believe that you could just break and then bring it to the other side.
I think there's a handful of myths that all kind of fall under one umbrella, and it's this disbelief in themselves myth. And the myths that fall under that umbrella are like, oh, it's too late, I don't have the resources, I miss the opportunity, I'm in the wrong market. You know, it's all of these little, some people might call them excuses, but really what they boil down to is a lack of self-belief. And I know we talked, and I mentioned a few times today, being fortunate and having blessings and being lucky. And those things are real. Those things exist. But I also believe that luck comes to those who are prepared and who consistently show up. Like, yeah, there might be one day where you get lucky and your reel goes viral, but that luck is going to happen a lot more often if you're posting a reel every single day. Like, you know, like you might be like, oh, well, this basketball player made this amazing, lucky, you know, game-winning shot, but they've taken 40 game-winning shots in their career. They've shot that exact shot in practice 40,000 times. And so the consistency, the dedication, the discipline to continue showing up and to stay consistent day after day, that creates the luck. That creates these opportunities. Yeah. And it doesn't take someone special. It doesn't take someone super smart. It doesn't take someone who's super good looking. It doesn't take any of those excuses that we tell ourselves of why we're not good enough. It's just like, hey, if you're willing to show up day after day after day after day, you'll have that success that you're looking for.
Like, so like basically it's probably like a matter of faith, having faith in yourself.
Yeah.
That I can do this. I guess, yeah, you're right. That is like a lot harder thing to overcome. It's easier said than done, right? Like, just be confident.
Definitely easier said than done. We're not all born with that. I think for some of us, there's different ways to achieve that. Some people do affirmations. Some people go to therapy. Some people read books. I'm a big fan of therapy myself. It changed my life. I know I left that out of the story today, but that was important for me. Yeah, that self-belief of, hey, I'm going to have faith to just keep showing up day after day and believe in myself and eventually I'll have success. It's a difference maker. I believe it might be difference maker.
Maybe one day you can come back and we can talk about your therapy.
Yeah, I'd be down. That's a whole can of worms.
When you said that sounded really intriguing. Okay, so I'll just kind of wrap it up with this. Like, what you know, I usually do this with a lot of like influencer clients. And like, if you were my client, how I would write this story is like, I call this like weakness to strength story, because it sounds like, because like that not believing in myself and then all of a sudden believing it, like you didn't go through that. I think you were kind of instilled like all of that. And so a lot of people struggle here because they're like, oh, I don't have a hero's journey. I was always good at this. You know, like, they're like that. So for those people, what I usually, what ends up happening there, I call this the weakness to strength story. I think maybe you, before we were talking about how you're like, yeah, it's like ego and that delusional thing. Maybe you saw that as kind of a weakness, this, you know, and then eventually it actually turns out that actually, you know, like we do need a little bit of delusional belief in ourselves and, you know, something like that. But yeah, it's interesting because, like, you know, I'm always trying to find, whenever I meet people, I'm trying to find out like, what's this person's story?
Yeah. So
thank you for sharing your whole story with us. It was super interesting. And I feel like I really know you now.
Oh, I appreciate that. It's rare that I do get to share my full story like this. I usually will abbreviate our entire conversation today into a 3-minute segment. So I really appreciate these questions, and I appreciate your perceptiveness as, you know, the quote unquote interviewer, the person asking the questions. It felt really nice and refreshing to be seen and to be able to talk about these things that I think ultimately make the biggest difference.
Oh, thank you so much, man. So let's do some plugs. So you have your Insta Club Hub. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you're promoting at the moment?
The Insta Club Hub is the go-to. We have a wide variety of free downloads that are like great for people who are just getting started. But the Insta Club Hub, that's the bread and butter. That's where we're funneling everyone.
Got it. So I'll put the link in the description. Definitely check out Brock's Instagram if you want to grow Instagram. I mean, you're probably following. If you're growing Instagram, you're already probably following it. But if you're not, definitely check him out. I'll put all the links below. Thank you so much, Brock, for your time. Thank you for sharing your story so openly. And thank you, everyone, for listening. Cheers. Bye.